Good morning. That's a dangerous song. I can almost lose my voice for the preach. That one just got to be careful. I'm over there saying, "No, don't. You won't be able to preach." Well, we're continuing on in Acts. Sometimes we just need a little bit of encouragement. Sometimes circumstances just seem like they don't end and they continue on, and it could be health, it could be finances. Now there's a verse in 1 Corinthians 10 that says, "No temptation has overtaken you but such as is common to man, and God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able." Do we really believe that? Because sometimes he might not tempt me beyond what I'm able, but he sure goes right up to the limit. Do you ever feel like that? That you're right at God, one more testing, you allow one more temptation, one more testing, and I don't know if you feel like you're right at the limit. Remember, we were in Brazil, and I'd been in Brazil about, three years, I think it is, and we were going to take a group of students. I was teaching at a Bible Institute, and we were going to take a group of students on a week-long ministry. And so I was getting ready and was going to drive my car. Well, silly me, I played soccer the night before we were going to leave, and sure enough, I broke my foot. So I had to get up early in the morning to go back to the hospital so they would put the cast on it and everything. And I couldn't drive the car because it was my right foot, and my right foot was immobilized in a cast. So I got one of the students to drive the car. Well, he smashed the car on the trip. And Brazilian seminary students are even poorer than American seminary students. And I knew there was no way he was going to be able to pay to fix the car. I also knew there was no way I was going to be able to fix the car. And so I'm laying in bed, and I'm thinking, and my foot is up in a, up elevated. And I'm thinking, my car is smashed. The back end was bad. I actually let two students drive it, and they both got in an accident. So, and so I'm thinking, I don't know how I'm going to pay for this. My foot's up, and I don't know what I'm going to do. God, I don't know what I'm going to do. And so on the radio, I turn the radio on. Now I'm in Brazil. The language of Brazil is, you guys know, Portuguese, right? I turn on the radio. I said, I got to listen to something. I turn on the radio, and in English, because HCJB is a radio station up in the top of the Andes, and the signal made it. It doesn't always come in clearly, but this one night it came in. I'm laying there, and on the radio comes the song, "His Eye is on the Sparrow." Do you know that song, "His Eye is on the Sparrow"? Why should my heart feel lonely? If he watches the sparrow, I know he watches me. And I'm laying in bed thinking, this is, and then that comes on the radio. In English, "His Eyes on the Sparrow" comes in over the radio. And I went, thank you, God. It was just, he didn't send me $1,000. He didn't do a miracle. But that coincidence, that divine coincidence, was amazing. And it was, and we still had to pay the bills. I still had to go for another 6 weeks with my leg in a cast. There was no healing, but I just went, oh. And sometimes we need that. Sometimes we just need a, oh, thank you, God. You need a little indication that God really does pay attention to what we're going through. Because sometimes, I know he says he does, but sometimes it seems like he's pushing that testing limit right up to the brink. Do you agree with me? Is that, you feel like that? Well, in Acts chapter 18, I feel like that's what's going on with Paul. Paul finds encouragement in Corinth. And we're going to see how these divine circumstances play out in the Apostle Paul's life. Well, you know, we've been talking about this. Paul's on this trip, right? He started down here in Jerusalem. He's gone all the way through here. He wanted to go up here, but God said, no, you can't go up there. So he makes his way over here. They have the first convert that's European, and that was, you guys remember, Lydia, right? And now he's around this area. He comes down. He gets chased out a couple of towns here. He's down. Now he's in Corinth. So he's all the way down here in Corinth. That's a long road trip. If you know anything about Corinth, it wasn't one of the best places. Corinth was known for two temples, two main temples. The Poseidon, you know who Poseidon is, the god of the sea, or Neptune is his name in the Roman culture, and Aphrodite. Now, what do you know about Aphrodite? Aphrodite was the goddess of, they call it love, but it's really lust and pleasure. Love and pleasure. So you can imagine what's going on in the name of religion in that town. And it was that way. It was an immoral town. It was very, very wealthy because, as you can tell where it is on the map, it was a port on both sides. And it was always full of sailors. Now, I'm not saying anything bad about Navy guys, all right? Memorial Day weekend and all that, I'm not making any comments about Navy guys. But you know as well as I do what goes on in port towns. And it was very, very wealthy. So they could buy whatever they want. And it actually became that if you called somebody a Corinthian, you were calling them an immoral person or somebody that was self-indulgent. So it was a slang for the town, for the whole area. If you were in another town, if you were in Rome and you said, well, you're a Corinthian, that didn't mean you're saying that the guy is from Corinth. You're calling him an immoral person. It had a reputation. I don't know, maybe when I think about it, I kind of think of New Orleans. I hope I didn't make anybody mad, but I've been to New Orleans, and it's not a great place to be. Well, that's where Paul ends up. After his travels and everything, he's now in this town of Corinth, which is a very immoral place. Well, I want you to think with me about the Apostle Paul a little bit. Now, I call these characteristics of Paul, and I say presumed. Well, it's probably not the right word, the best word, but when I think of Paul, the words that pop into my head to describe the Apostle Paul, you know, knowing the way he was and the way he acted, when I think of who Paul was as a person, what are the first characteristics that I think of? Well, first, strong-willed. If you think of the Apostle Paul, you think of him as being very strong-willed, almost to the point of stubborn. And you kind of had to be. I mean, to do what he did and to put up with the things that he put up with. But I used to think, I don't know if, you know, yeah, I want to meet Paul in heaven, but I'm not sure he's the first guy. And I think we might have a little clash of personalities because he seems like kind of a difficult personality, a guy that knows what he's going for and get out of my way and you can't make me. I think of him as brave and courageous, right? I mean, for a guy to travel all over the world and be the first believer in a place and say, I'm going to tell you something that nobody has ever told you about before. And I'm going to talk about Jesus, this guy that was crucified and that rose again. You got to have some courage to do that. You can't just be a, well, I don't know if you guys want to hear this or not, but because they'll just do what you guys did. They'll just laugh you out. So I think he's brave and courageous, strong-willed, brave and courageous, convinced of his message and confrontational. He doesn't seem to back down to too many people. He tells the Pharisees what's going on. He tells the chief priests what's going on. He tells the proconsul what's going on. He even says, take me to Caesar. He's convinced. and confrontational. I always pictured him as a guy, I wonder if there's anybody here I can get in an argument with. That's kind of the picture. But I learned some things about him when I was this week and the last few weeks. In 2 Corinthians, it's interesting, in the book of 2 Corinthians, he's writing to the church in Corinth. This is later. He's writing a letter back to the church at Corinth, and he says, you know what? I'm writing you this letter instead of coming to you in person because I don't want to come and make you sad because you guys aren't doing what you're supposed to be doing. He actually says, I need to come and give you guys a little encouragement, but you know what? I don't want to come that way. I don't want to come and confront you like that. I'm going to write you this letter and give you some time to put it into practice. I don't want to come and yell at you right now. That'll make you sad. That'll make me sad. I never really understood. Paul didn't always pick a fight when he had the chance to pick a fight. He actually says, if I come to you now, I'm going to be too mad, and I don't want to come and be that way. So I picture him as convinced and confrontational, but he's not. There are some people that they'll just tell you what it's like every time, whether you want to know it or not. Right? I could probably point at a few in here if I wanted to. Paul was like that a lot, but sometimes he said, you know what? I don't need to do that right now. But now here are some characteristics of Paul that are demonstrated in this text. We're in Acts chapter 18. I'm just going to read through a little bit of it right now. Acts chapter 18, starting at verse 1. After these things, he left Athens and went to Corinth, and he found a Jew named Aquila, a native of Pontus, having recently come from Italy with his wife Priscilla, because Claudius had commanded all the Jews to leave Rome. He came to them, and because he was of the same trade, he stayed with them, and they were working, for by trade they were tent makers. And he was reasoning in the synagogue every Sabbath and trying to persuade Jews and Greeks. Well, some characteristics about Paul that show up here. He's persistent. Right? What does it say he was doing? He was reasoning in the synagogue. How often? Every Sabbath. Every Sabbath. How many of you guys go to church every Sunday? There's their hands down here. You know, when I was a kid, that was basically what you did. And you actually, maybe it was only the Baptists that did it, but I had pins for perfect attendance, you know. Even when we were traveling out of town, you had to go to a church and get a bulletin and take it back to your Sunday school class. How many did that? Yeah, you had to get a bulletin and take it back to your Sunday school class, and then your teacher would mark you that, yes, you went to church while you were out of town. And I don't remember. I think it was 4 years without missing. Isn't that ridiculous? 4 years without missing a Sunday? That's crazy, right? Who's gone 4 years without missing a Sunday? You must have been a Baptist, right? That used to be normal. For now, it's a, yeah, well, I'm out of town this weekend. But anyway, Paul, every Sabbath, he's going to the synagogue. He's devoted. If you look down at verse 5, but when Silas and Timothy came from Macedonia, Paul began devoting himself. The word devoted means completely enwrapped. It's actually a prison term. He was held captive by the word. That's how much time he was spending. It's like he was in prison with the word. Where's Paul? Well, he's locked up right now. He's spending that much time. It's like he was being held captive by the word. That's how he was devoted. He was devoted. Thorough. There in verse 5 it says, he began devoting himself completely to the word, solemnly testifying to the Jews that Jesus was the Christ. That word solemnly testifying, giving full testimony, explaining every detail, answering every question. So if he'd raise a point, they'd ask questions, and he'd give the explanation for it. Every detail, that's how intense he was. Every Sabbath, he's in there. He's devoting himself to making sure that he understands completely the script. Now, the word that he's talking about here is what? It's the Old Testament. He's devoting himself to the Old Testament, making sure that he understands completely the Old Testament. Because if you remember, he was raised a Jew, and now he's a believer, and he realizes, you know what, that Old Testament is talking about Jesus. And so he's got to go back and rethink everything that he thought about the Old Testament. He has to realize, oh, that Messiah, that's Jesus. And he's going through, he's probably doing an inductive Bible study, saying, oh, that's Jesus. Well, that's Jesus. That pillar of fire and that cloud of smoke, the clouds in the daytime in the wilderness, that's Jesus. That rock that Moses beat and the water came out of, that's representing Jesus. That serpent that was lifted up in the wilderness, that all you had to do was look at it and you were saved, that's representing Jesus. Oh, that lamb that Abraham caught in the thicket and sacrificed up on the hill, that's representing Jesus. And he had to go back through everything and remember, that's talking about Jesus. And I can just imagine the Jews in the audience going, well, what about, you know, David when he was praying, the Lord is my shepherd? And Paul says, that Lord is Jesus, the good shepherd. And then a Jew would raise another question. Well, what about? He said, that's Jesus too. So Paul had a lot to rethink. And he wants to make sure he's getting it right. He's devoting himself. He's testifying, because imagine the questions if you had been raised a Jew and all of a sudden somebody says, Jesus is the fulfillment of that Messiah we've been waiting for. Well, is that what Isaiah 53 is talking about when it says he was beaten and he was wounded and with his stripes we are healed? Oh, so there was a lot that he had to make sure, and people would have questions all over the place. So he was thorough. I also think of him as responsible and conscientious. Now, there's a little twist on this if you look at verse 6. But when they resisted and blasphemed, he shook out his garments and said to them, your blood be on your own heads. I'm clean. From now on, I will go to the Gentiles. Now, I left one off of your notes there. He's responsible, he's conscientious, and then just in the side there, right, and he's frustrated. And he's frustrated. Now, by responsible and conscientious, when it says here that these guys, they resisted and they blasphemed, you have to realize they weren't questioning, what does this mean? They understood completely what he was saying. It wasn't that, oh, well, I don't understand that point, Paul. They weren't questioning the points that Paul was making. They were saying, we don't like those points. It's different. If you go to somebody and you ask them, or you tell them the gospel and say, I don't understand. Jesus, he's God and he's man at the same time. And can you explain that to me? That's a sincere question asking for more clarification. But when somebody says, oh, I understand. You're telling me Jesus is God and he's man and he died on a cross for my sins. Huh. I don't accept it. I think you're ridiculous. I think that's stupid. That's two different people there. You see that? That's two completely different situations. And Paul, when they constantly resisted and they blasphemed, Paul said, that's it for you guys. I'm not going to keep doing this. I'm not going to keep arguing with you because you understand what I'm saying. You just don't want to accept what I'm saying. Now, in case you think that Paul's being a meanie here, Jesus actually told his disciples to do that. Jesus said, when you go into a city, when he sent out his disciples, when you go into the city and you explain things to them, if they reject your message, shake the dust off of your shoes and go to the next town. Jesus said to do that. And it was actually in the Old Testament in Ezekiel. God told Ezekiel to do that. Ezekiel, you're going to go and you're going to prophesy. Now, when they understand what you're saying, if they reject that prophecy, you're clear of their blood. You don't have to worry. I'm not going to hold that against you. Now, if you don't explain to them what they're doing wrong, you're going to be guilty. But if you explain to them and they reject it, you're off the hook. And that's what Paul's saying here. Now, when Paul says, your blood be on your own heads, I'm clean. From now on, I'm going to the Gentiles. I used to think this was a statement, I'm not going to go to the Jews anymore. But I think what he's talking about is, you guys here in Corinth, I'm not going to go to the Jews anymore. Here in Corinth. Why? Well, because he had said this a couple chapters earlier in another place. He said, I'm not going to go to you anymore. I'm going to the Gentiles. And then here, two chapters later, he's doing it again. I think he's saying, you Jews here in Corinth, I'm not going to spend the time with you. And also in chapter 19, if you look at chapter 19, verse 8, it says, and he entered the synagogue and continued speaking boldly for 3 months. So he's going to the synagogue in another town. So when he says, I'm done with you Jews, he's not saying, I'm done with all Jews ever. I'm never going to talk to another Jewish guy again. He's saying, you Jews here in Corinth have had your chance, and you understand it, but you're resisting it. Blaspheme means to not recognize the value of it. They were not recognizing the value of what Paul was saying. And resisted, this word here, resisted, means organized opposition. So they were raising up people to go against him. It means to square off against, and you line the troops up, you're saying, we're not going to accept this. So it was a confrontation. And Paul said, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to do that. So he was responsible, he was conscientious, and he was frustrated. Also, he was fearful. Paul, the courageous, Paul, the brave, he was fearful. Well, what is true courage? Is true courage not being afraid? I think true courage is being afraid but doing what you're supposed to do anyway. I mean, when you got somebody shooting at you, you ought to be afraid, right? But courage is holding your ground, firing back, not taking off and running. Well, look here at verse 9. And the Lord said to Paul in a night vision. So Paul gets a little vision here, and God says, do not be afraid any longer. Literally saying, stop being afraid. Well, if he has to stop being afraid, that means what? He was afraid, right? Paul the courageous. He was told to stop being afraid. Well, now we're going to go through, I think Paul at this point needs some encouragement. I think he's had a rough time. He's got opposition. Now, remember his journey. He wanted to go into Bithynia. Okay? He had wanted to go to Bithynia. Let's see if it's, oh, no, not there. He wanted to go to Bithynia, but he wasn't permitted to go to Bithynia. All right? I don't know if you've ever been planning a trip or you wanted to be a missionary and you were thinking you were going to go one place and all of a sudden, I mean, you guys know the Daniels, Matt and Jen Daniels are trying to raise money and support and everything to go to Japan. They've been doing that for a couple of years now. Can you imagine? They've been trying to understand the Japanese culture. They've been telling everybody they're going. Can you imagine all of a sudden somebody comes and says, we want you to go to China instead of Japan? That's like a knife. When we were getting ready to go as missionaries to Brazil, I mean, for years, you know, we're planning this. And I can just imagine what it would have been like if somebody would have called and said, we want you to go to South Africa instead of Brazil. It's a hard thing. But Paul was wanting to go to Bithynia, but he wasn't permitted to. Now, in just a couple of chapters earlier, he was beaten. So imagine that. You want to go to Bithynia. God says no. So you go to Philippi. And what happens in Philippi? You get beat up. You get beat up and put in prison. At about this time, you're thinking, what's going on here? He's been on the road for probably a year at this point. So he's been traveling for a year, more or less, wanting to go one place. God says go to another. And when he gets to that other place, what happens? He gets beaten and put in prison. About that time, you need to be laying in bed, turn the radio on, and hear something. Because you're not sure you're in the right spot. Then after that, he gets chased out of Thessalonica. Just preaching the gospel, doing what God told him to do. And in chapter 17, verses 1 through 9, the Thessalonians don't like it, or the Thessalonians, or whatever they're called. And the brethren, in verse 10, the brethren immediately sent Paul and Silas away by night to Berea. He has to get out of town at nighttime. You need some encouragement. And then the next, they're in Berea, and what happens? The same crowd from Thessalonica comes to Berea and starts causing trouble again. And look at verse 14, 17 verse 14. Then immediately the brethren sent Paul out to go as far as the sea, and Silas and Timothy remained there. So now he's getting singled out, and he's being sent away by himself. He's the main troublemaker. Silas and Timothy, they get to stay in town. They say, Paul, you got to get out of here. And he goes by himself. I'd be a little discouraged at this point. And then they sneer at him in Athens. So now he's in Athens, and they start making fun of him. Verse 32. Now when they heard of the resurrection of the dead, some began to sneer at him. Loser. That word sneer at him, that's the same thing they said about the disciples on the day of Pentecost. Which, by the way, do you know what today is? I just gave you the answer. Today's Pentecost. But remember what happened on the day of Pentecost? The Spirit filled all the disciples. They went out and they started speaking in tongues. And what did the crowd say? These guys are drunk. These guys are full of it. And that's exactly what they were saying to Paul. Paul, you must be drunk. You're crazy. Now, I don't know about you, but I think I'd be in the need of a little bit of encouragement at this time. Well, I think God knows exactly what Paul was going through. And I think that he arranged a series of divine coincidences. Maybe it's divine coincidi. I don't know. Well, what's the first one? The first divine coincidence in verse 2. And he found, now, so Paul's, he left Athens and he comes to Corinth, and he's by himself in Corinth. He had to leave Silas and Timothy. He's been run out of a couple of towns. He's coming into Corinth. And he just so happens to find a couple of Jews named Aquila and Priscilla. And what are they doing there? Well, I don't know if God arranges circumstances, global circumstances, just to meet individual needs. But it seems like he did that here. Because the emperor in Rome at this time is Claudius. And Claudius made an edict. He didn't like the Jews were causing problems up in Rome. And he said, I want all the Jews out of town. Every Jew get out of here. Now, he didn't pass this through the Senate. For that to go into permanent effect, it would have had to have gone through the Senate, but he didn't do that. He just made a presidential edict. He said, Jews out of town. And what's so funny is when an emperor makes an edict like that, it lasts only as long as he's alive. And then he dies, and it goes back to normal. Well, it's a divine coincidence, but the end of this year that Paul is in Corinth, guess who dies? So it's almost as if this edict had the specific purpose of getting Aquila and Priscilla out of town to Athens. Because within a year, Claudius is dead, and the Jews all go back to where they came from. It was only in effect for a couple of years. It reminds me when I was in seminary, we were going to go to Austria for a summer mission. And it was the year that Chernobyl, the reactor blew up. You guys remember that? And I remember a guy coming to me and saying, "I think that's God telling you not to go." And I said, "God doesn't have to blow up a reactor. I mean, if he just sends me a letter saying don't go, I won't go. He doesn't have to blow up a reactor and affect the entire world." But here it seems like God, in order to get Aquila and Priscilla to be in Corinth, he kicked out all the Jews out of Rome. And where are Aquila and Priscilla from? They're from Pontus. Well, where is Pontus? Do you see up here at the top? Now, where was Paul trying to go on his trip? Right there. He was here, and he wanted to go up there. And God said, "No, you go over there. But don't worry, I'll bring, if Muhammad doesn't go to the mountain." That would be so encouraging as a missionary. You wanted to go to one place. God says, "No, you can't go there. I'm sending you someplace else." And when you get to that someplace else, there are people from where you wanted to go that are there to join your team. I don't know if you can picture that, but that had to be very encouraging to Paul, that he now has people from the place that he wanted to go that are followers. And they encourage him. And it just so happens that what's their job? What a coincidence. They're tent makers. Well, who else is a tent maker? Paul. It says right there. He came to them, and because he was of the same trade, he stayed with them, and they were working, for by trade they were tent makers. Now remember, Paul's by himself at this point. He left Silas and Timothy up north and had to come down, and he was working by himself. Now what a coincidence that God brings a couple of people from the place that he had wanted to go to originally, that just happened to have been kicked out of Rome, that just happened to be tent makers, to work with him. That's like turning on the radio and hearing "His eye is on the sparrow." And then Silas and Timothy come back in verse 5. "But when Silas and Timothy came down from Macedonia," and this is interesting, "Paul began devoting himself completely to the word." He had his company back. He had his friends back. And you can tell there's a re-energizing, because now is when he can devote himself completely to the word. Now remember, Paul, in the next verses, he gets upset at the Jews and he says, "I'm not going to go to you guys anymore." So he keeps preaching, and who becomes a believer here? Look at verse 7. "Then he left there and went to the house of a man named Titius Justus, a worshiper of God." And what is the divine coincidence here? "Whose house was next door to the synagogue." What a coincidence. It just so happens that this guy that, now it says he's a worshiper of God, so that probably means he doesn't understand the whole gospel yet. And so Paul is going to start meeting, "I'm not going to the synagogue anymore, I'll just go next door to the synagogue." And so Titius becomes a believer. Now remember, Paul said he wasn't going to go to the Jews anymore. He's going next door. But guess who the next convert is? Crispus. And who is Crispus? Verse 8, "Crispus, the leader of the synagogue." Paul was frustrated. "I'm not going to the Jews anymore. I've had it with you guys here." So he goes next door, starts preaching. And who's one of the first converts? The leader of the synagogue. Wouldn't that be a shot in the arm? That would, to me, that would, hey, that's great. Then what happens? verse 9. And this is where Paul has his vision, where God says, don't be afraid any longer. Verse 9, and the Lord said to Paul in the night by a vision, do not be afraid any longer, but go on speaking and do not be silent. Now, if you're thinking of Paul's situation, you would be afraid, right? You've been in the stocks just a couple of towns earlier. You've been chased out of the last two towns. Now you're in this town, and you got opposition from the Jews, and you could be a little on edge, right? And God says, don't worry about it. Keep speaking, for I am with you, and no man will attack you in order to harm you, for I have many people in this city. That's turning on the radio and hearing his eyes on the sparrow. And Paul's no dummy, because you know what he does? How long does he stay in Corinth? A year and a half. That, to me, God says, as long as you're in this town, nobody's going to hurt you. So Paul says, I'm hanging out here for a while. Right? He stayed a year and a half in Corinth. But there is opposition, and the Jews, they come, and they grab, and they take him in front of the proconsul. Now, Paul's been here, done that. And I'm sure he's hanging on to God's promise, but he's been there, done that, and knows what happens at these. But they go before the proconsul. The Jews take him up before the proconsul, and the proconsul say, and the Jews say, he's teaching against our laws, and he's blaspheming against our God. And you know what the proconsul says? This is what we do in Brazil. He says, I could care less. I don't care. This is a matter for the Jews. I don't care what you guys do. Now, wouldn't that be great? He says, get out of here. I don't want to hear it. I don't care at all. I have absolutely no desire to hear what you guys are arguing about. Leave me alone. Now, I'm sure Paul was feeling pretty good at the time, but look what happens next. This is a crack up. So Sosthenes, who was the leader now of the Jews, Crispus became a believer, and so Sosthenes takes over as leader of the Jews. So the crowd, they got to beat somebody. So who do they beat? Sosthenes that brought Paul before the proconsul. Now, I don't know, what would you be thinking if you were Paul? What was that? Woohoo! I don't know if he's laughing at the irony, if he's just glad it's not him. But can you imagine? Oh, they're dragging me before, and the proconsul says, Paul, get out of here. Paul goes, and they start beating the tar out of the guy that started the whole thing. Now, come on, guy. There's got to be a little bit of, well, better him than me in that, right? But just so you get the full picture, Sosthenes becomes a follower of Jesus. In 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 1, Paul says, greet my brother Sosthenes. So they beat him into the kingdom. So that's the situation. Paul has been, he's had a rough trip. He's been on the road for a year. He wanted to go one place, and God said, no, you can't go there. So he goes where God tells them to go. He gets beaten, put in prison, chased out of a couple of towns. He's on his own. He's all by himself. And God says, Paul, I think you need some encouragement. I'm going to send you a couple of guys. You don't know them, but they're tent makers just like you, and they're going to encourage you in your work. I'm going to bring Silas and Timothy back, and they're going to re-energize you, and you can get back to devoting yourself to the Scriptures. I know you're frustrated with the Jews, and I know you blew up at them, but guess what? I'm going to convert two leaders of the synagogue for you. And I know you're afraid. I'm going to let you stay in this place for a year and a half, and you don't have to worry about getting beaten at all. And the guy that's causing the trouble, he's going to get beat instead, and he's going to become a follower of Jesus Christ. I don't know how you can look at that and say, I think God knows what Paul needed at that time. The details, God is in the... Now, isn't that amazing how he worked all that? This is what I get out of it when I read it. God, you are amazing. He knows what we need when we need it. His ways definitely are not our ways. I don't have a clue sometimes why he's doing it the way he's doing it. But his plan is going to happen. He is going to accomplish his plan. And he is sovereign over events and circumstances. It reminded me when I was reading it this week of the book of Esther. God is not mentioned at all in the book of Esther, but the way the circumstances happen in the book of Esther, you come away thinking, I think God's in control of what's going on here. So when I think of the book of Acts, I don't think of it as the Acts of the Apostles. It's the Acts of God. God is the one that's working in this situation. Now, I know the title says Acts of the Apostles, but when you read it and you see the details, you say, God, look what you're doing. Do you know what you're doing? Look how you did this. And I come away going, you are just amazing. And there's a verse in 1 Peter 5:6-7, says, humble yourself under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you in due time. And translation for that is, realize that God is in control. His sovereign hand is over you. And then the next verse says, casting all your cares upon him, because he cares for you. And that's what I got out of Acts 18. God is in control. There's no question that he's in the details and he knows what's happening. And his hand is sovereign. And he arranged even at the level of the emperor of Rome to say, why don't you just kick those Jews out of here for a week? Because I got a guy down in Corinth that needs to meet a couple of those guys because he's getting really tired right now. And he needs some encouragement. God is amazing. And he cares about the details. And when he says, no temptation has taken you but such which is common to man, but God will provide a way of escape. He knows what my individual struggles are. And he knows when I'm laying in bed with a broken foot and a smashed up car, that when I turn on the radio, I need to hear His Eye Is on the Sparrow in English. Sometimes it's right on the line. God, I'm not sure if I'm in the right place doing the right thing. I think I'm following you. Could you just give me a little bit of encouragement? Now, I'm sure that each one of you could probably think of some time when you were right at the edge. Now, the thing is, we don't know where the edge is. God knows where the edge is. And sometimes we think, I can't take one more step of this faith thing. God, oh, I think you can take one more step of that faith thing. But right when you can't take one more step of the faith thing is when he says, let me give you a little shot of encouragement. God is amazing. Let's pray. Thank you, Father, that you love us individually. And you know what each one of us needs. And you know when we need it. You know before we need it. And you are able to take control and to govern, even on a global level, to let us see your hand working. And just like you encouraged Paul and re-energized his ministry, gave him courage to continue on, Father, we need that too. We might be facing health issues that just seem to keep on coming. We might be facing financial issues that just don't seem to go away. Relationship problems that someone in our family just isn't following you, or that we're struggling with an addiction. Father, you know what each one of us needs. Thank you that you love us individually. You're concerned. Help us to cast our cares on you confessing and admitting that you care for us. Thank you. In Jesus' name, amen.